Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. This is going to be the last in this mini-series of programs on University Matters on Campus FM with regard to the Faculty for the Built Environment. This mini-series is really a celebration, part of the celebration, of the centenary of the faculty, 1915-2015, and we'll be hearing more about that from the Dean today, Professor Alex Torpiano. I won't give a long bio because I'd like to hear a lot about what he has to say. So just to say, of course, that he qualified here at the University of Malta as an architect in 77. He actually received the Dean Laureate Helwa Prize for Architecture in 1975. He went on to read for a Master of Science at Imperial College London, which he followed with a PhD from the University of Bath in UK, and since that time has been associated with the faculty and also is well known as a professional architect outside the university as well. Welcome to the program, Professor Torpiano. We're here today to learn a little bit about the history of the faculty, considering that this is the centenary, and also I think to hear that although the centenary is 1915, study of architecture even went back further than that. Tell us about it.
To me, the opportunity to have a celebration, I think, comes at the right moment of the development of the faculty, which I'll speak about later on. But 1915 marked the first faculty, autonomous faculty of engineering and architecture, but it came out of another faculty of literature and sciences, which was, as a result of the statute of the 1915, divided into three faculties: faculty of literature, faculty of science, and faculty of engineering and architecture. In fact,
we're celebrating also the faculty of science this year.
In fact, incidentally, it was called the faculty of arts was called faculty of literature first, not quite faculty of art, but anyway, I haven't found out when they changed their name. The incorporation, however, of teaching in the university at university level is about 10 years before that, 1905, when there were the first what they called academical. That's how they call them, academical courses in engineering and architecture, coming probably from previous courses which were offered at a place, an institution which I found referred to as the Collegio di Malta or Collegio di Città, I think a form of almost polytechnic in a way. And there are references to courses being held in this institution at least from the 1831, 1832. I mean, Andres Ammit in his book, Our Architects, talks about records that he has, graduates from 1836 to the 1839 cohort. Before that, probably there were some training courses, mainly in mathematics and surveying. It's very interesting that the profession, which we now call perit, comes from quite a pedigree from the master masons. A perit is an expert, that's what the word means. And the organization of this was changed when the knights came because they felt that the master masons were very good with their materials, were not experienced in the newer type of construction. So they sent some of the best ones they sent abroad. They brought in people like Lapparelli, so the key ones. But they organized the profession, and you will find references in the 18th century to, for example, their fees and how they're organized, and the building control board, or the equivalent of MEPA at that time. Very interesting structure. Andres Ammit focused to me the first time, I didn't realize, this idea that there was a numerus clausus way back from the period of before the knights, but all through the knights, there were only 12 that were allowed to join the profession of perit. In the British period, they then, in fact, they used to appoint them as supernumerary. So, you know, they knew they were extra to them. And this idea of the 12 is curious. I don't know why 12, where it came from. But it apparently remained as a limit to the number of professionals, periti, because they weren't professionals then, who could practice who could take control of the building operation.
And when the British created the statute, it created many changes, obviously, within the university, and particular interest to me because I've done a bit of research on the first female graduates came into the university, and that the system within the university became more like the British system.
It became more like the British system. It was not an easy time for university, I think. There was a lot of pressure, the political pressure, I mean, I suppose there always is, but it was very, very strong because what happened after the Knights, finances of the university depended exclusively on the government, as they do now almost. But that before that, there were foundations that the university could use to pay professors, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So, but during the British period, they depended on the funds from the government completely. And the fact that in 1898 there was a new statute which dissolved the previous Senate, the university had a degree of autonomy before then, but it dissolved the previous Senate, shows also the pressure from government to...
Also from the language point of view,
of course. It all starts from the language point of view. So, and in 1898, the General Council was set up with a strictly advisory role. And I think it was that General Council then that discussed over a relatively short period of time. I found the first meeting on the new statute of which then eventually became the 1915 statute. They started discussing in September 1914. And they had meetings practically every 2 weeks for a period of about 4 months, where they discussed the draft, the clauses, and then eventually they submitted these to the governor for promulgation. And the date is actually, if I remember correctly, 19th May 1915. That's when the statute was published June, but it was given the date of May 1915. So we're actually now practically a month away from that centenary. The debate was very interesting. It wasn't only, obviously, about the faculties, but they took the opportunity to set up... I found a definition of the university in that statute, which is very interesting, because it focuses on teaching, it talks about research, and it talks also about what I would say the equivalent of outreach. So again, those three objectives that nowadays we consider as important for a modern university... I think that's the first time where you start seeing them, because prior to that it was mostly teaching. But that's when they start to talk about teaching, research, and outreach, making a difference to people's lives.
The lecturers, do we know who they were at that time?
Well, I found the names of the examiners in the first course, and I found the syllabus very interesting. The first courses were, well, it's actually called the Bachelor of Engineering and Architecture, and it remained like that on and off. I mean, I have a Bachelor of Engineering and Architecture, and I graduated in 1977. There was a period in between where that degree was not offered by the university. There were different degrees. But after 1972, we retained the BE and A until, last year, effectively, the last BE and A last year. But that was the degree which was offered also in 1915. Curiously, they were offered also the Doctor of Engineering and Architecture within the same structure. But I don't know of any who had actually attained that status. The degree was a four-year course. And, we find the syllabus, we find the subject that they studied, very typical, mathematics, engineering, architecture. But then you start seeing, for example, some interesting subjects like hydraulics, like heat engines. In their third year, I think, they study heat engines. We're very curious because, to a certain extent, it's also reflecting what is happening in England with the civil engineer. The civil engineer...
Technology was changing.
Technology was changing after the Industrial Revolution. We only had the Industrial the civil engineer, the modern civil engineer, came out of the Industrial Revolution. And it came out in the UK as a completely different animal from the architect, completely different. Because the architects were not interested in those subjects, railway stations, harbours, railway engines themselves. So the first civil engineers then became interested in the machines. So the first mechanical engineers were a group of civil engineers who started talking about their railway engine. Electrical engineers also came out. And that type of structure remains even today in the UK. The institutions of electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, structural engineering, retain a link between them, which they don't have with architects. Right? So that's just curious, because there is a reflection of this in what happens later. Then the other interesting thing is that the people who were appointed as examiners, I found names like Lorenzo Gatt, for example. Lorenzo Gatt is a you know, very important character. But when you look at his qualifications, you find that he was called already Perito Architetto Agrimensore. And this is before the 1919 law. So it's just a title which is comes not from the law, but from practice, I think. The word perito is used there. It had been used. It's used in different contexts. I'll say something about it in a minute. It's called architetto, and he's also called agrimensore, which means land surveyor, because land surveying was a very important function of that professional way back from the knights, because most of the issues of quarrels of land ownership and division of land and giving advice to the court about value. So that was a very important statement. But he was also, later on, became an associate member of the UK Institution of Civil Engineers, which means that there was already an affiliation with civil engineering. But in his career, he worked as the manager and the engineer of the Malta Railway Company in 1895. So he was not referred only as the administrator, but as the engineer of that company. And he also worked later on as the chief engineer of waterworks and electrical light department. So he was really a Renaissance man in that sense. But it marks this, I think it mirrors this, what was happening in the UK, that the civil engineers eventually break into the different specializations of engineering that we see today.
But he didn't build structures as such?
No, he did. He was actually responsible for a number of projects. Eventually, he also became superintendent of the public works. So he was responsible for a lot of things. But and there was also eventually, he set up a scholarship for students of architecture, the Lorenzo Gatt Scholarship, which is now an obscure thing. I don't know if it actually still exists, but I remember in my time there was still reference to this Lorenzo Gatt Scholarship for students of engineering and architecture. And later on, in 1919, he's also one of the founder members of what was then called the Camera degli Architetti ed Agrimensori, because the first title in Italian was actually Camera degli Architetti ed Agrimensori, so Chamber of Architects and Land Surveyors.
These connections hung on, I suppose,
yes,
over the years.
Yes, it remained. It remained.
So over the next century, obviously the next 50 years perhaps, things started then to fade away. The Italianate side of it started to fade away.
But in the case of our profession, in 1919, you find references to the Camera degli Architetti ed Agrimensori as a formal title. In 1920, the following day, is the Chamber of Architects and Land Surveyors, and very quickly, Chamber of Architects and Civil Engineers. And that is also one of the earliest, professional institutions to be set up in 1920. And the title of Perit then almost disappears, because from then on, people were referred to as architects and civil engineers. You know, they even from the university, they obtained a diploma in architecture and civil engineering. In the vernacular, of course, Perit still remains. Perit, it's not the only context that's used, as you know.
No.
I mean, in the courts, we use it as an expert. But he was actually an expert, considered an expert. In the older texts, you sometimes find references to, for example, Lorenzo Gatt, I found referred to as perito ed architetto, so expert and architect. But in other contexts, I found reference to, for example, perito agrimensore, so the expert land surveyor, or even the perito apprezzatore, which is the expert land valuer. So it's not exactly clear what the formal meaning of the term was, but the association with the profession was there.
What about numbers of students? I mean, do we know, did they grow over the years? Did the 12 increase?
12 increased, but they increased, first of all, they increased coming from the master mason. As I said, master masons who were good, who were then offered courses in mathematics, who were sent abroad. So they, rather than waiting for somebody to retire before finding their place, I mean, especially in the British period, they started to go beyond the 12. Of course, it had important importance in the amount of money they earned, so it was an important position.
And also at that time, I'm thinking of the early 20th century, there must have been something of a building boom in Malta, because if you look around at some of the houses, say, in Rabat, or when you're moving out of the village core, but the houses are still quite early houses, there must have been quite a boom.
Yes, and the numbers were, even though perhaps they went beyond the 12, they were still very limited. The first courses that I mentioned, which were pre-university, 1836 to 1839, for example, it was first of all a course that was offered every 3 years, and we know that there were about six students registered for that. So that's six potential graduates over a three-year period. The numbers were never very large. There were courses where you had two students. Merit Mintoff was one of two students in his particular course.
And I believe there was one, he was on his own.
On his own, exactly.
Was actually referred to as Il Corso.
Exactly. So the numbers were never large. Even when I I first registered as a student, and at that time the course opened every 2 years, and my course had 10 students.
Now, but not because there was a numerous classes,
no,
but because
no,
it was a difficult
no,
course.
No, it was a difficult course, and it didn't, well, it, people, well, there wasn't a numerous classes, but people had, I think, still this idea, we really shouldn't have too many. How can the small island take so many of these same professionals? By the 1950s, there's another period which I'm not completely clear about because I haven't found enough documentation, but there are some survivors of that period, and that period is very interesting because even though last year the Faculty of Engineering celebrated the 50th anniversary, I think, of their first BEng courses, in reality, in 1950, there were BEng courses in our faculty. And these were offered, from what people have told me, because they're survivors, I'll mention a couple of names, during their course, they started the course of engineering and architecture, and during their course they were told, look, if you're interested in electrical engineering, or if you're interested in mechanical engineering, or even in civil engineering, we can give you a scholarship, you go away to Great Britain, and you will get a BEng in that discipline. And some of them did that. One of them, Patrick Sullivan, who obtained a scholarship in the 50s to go to Imperial College, and he remained there since. But he went out and he obtained a BEng from the University of Malta on the basis of that. Perita Lulvincenti, still alive, also one of the first to get a BEng in electrical engineering, even though he's a Perit, he's actually formally, and others, Maurice Gallia, who went in mechanical engineering. So it's an interesting period because, again, I refer to what was happening in the UK, and somehow it arrived at our shores a bit later on, but they all came out from that faculty.
Perhaps I'm anticipating what you're going to say later on, but in a way, it does reflect what's happening a little bit now in your faculty, in the sense that you are now reflecting society out there, you are interested in things that are going on out there, and therefore your students are studying subjects which perhaps 20 years ago they were not going to be studying.
Yeah. I think it is important to... I talk about history because it's a way of also explaining that what we're doing is not really revolutionary, but it is reflecting what is happening today. Numbers in our courses increased rapidly, dramatically. Courses, the BEng course started to be offered every year. I became involved in lecturing in 79, fresh out of university, so I knew it then. But in the 80s, in the 88, effectively, there was a big push and numbers grew. And by the time I came back as dean, but now 7 years ago, 2008, we had an average of about 60 to 70 students per year over 5 years. So that's a lot of them. Okay, not necessarily all of them graduated, but a good number of them. So even if you say 50 per year, that's in one particular five-year generation. Suddenly, we had, I mean, my professional registration number is 132. Right, so that is in 79. Now we're in the 800 something, okay, and that is an indication of what has happened. And partly because of that, but also partly because of the increase of the let's say, the content of each discipline. Disciplines have grown. We decided that we ought to encourage students to look beyond the traditional architect and civil engineer parameter, not because we don't like the idea, but because there's more than that. There's more than that. I mean, as you said earlier, I've worked a lot in industry, and you know, there you realize that we have, when I try to employ graduates, a lot of graduates in one discipline, very good ones, a lot of graduates in one other discipline, very good ones, but nothing else in the other things. So planning became more important, issues like conservation became more important. So in 2008, when we started this first restructuring of the faculty, to me, it was clear that the name itself of the faculty was a limitation to how people perceived our preparation. I mean, we're still referred to as the Il Facultat al Periti. Okay, and I struggle. Even the rector sometimes says, "You're the Faculty of Architecture." And I tell him, "No, hold on a minute. We're not the Faculty of Architecture. We have now 7 departments, which is beyond the Faculty of Architecture." I have to remind him, even though he was a protagonist in the chain. So, but it's in the mindset.
It remains.
So we started by saying, okay, let's look at what's happening to Malta, and with very quick discussions, we came up with this name, built environment. At first, I thought people would say, "But what on earth are you saying?" You know, built environment. The translation in Maltese was not uncomfortable, but was not ambient mibni. You know, what was it? So both Italian name with a Maltese name, Semitic word. So it's a bit of a funny word. But very quickly, I started receiving messages from outside the faculty, from outside the university, from the profession and from the politicians. Said, "Yeah, it's a brilliant idea. Why didn't we think of that before?" So I think now people are comfortable with the idea that we are interested in the built environment. We're interested in developing, let's say, parallels with the faculty for, faculty institute of earth systems, because so that's the unbuilt environment, as it were, and we're the built environment. And we need, obviously, synergies between us. We have grown. We started originally with 2 departments, but we also had the Institute for Masonry and Construction Research, Professor Kassar, who was one of the founder academics in that institute with me. We decided that we would make that institute a mainstream department in order to, again, show students that conservation heritage is not an adjunct, which you do, if you wish, as a postgraduate, almost like an afterthought, but it's mainstream. And very soon we added spatial planning and infrastructure, which again is very innovative, because in many other schools abroad, the infrastructure is considered as a civil engineering subject. By infrastructure, I mean road systems, water, waste management. Okay, we don't have rivers and river control. So those are considered to be civil engineering subjects. We decided to put them with planning more than with the engineering, because we said the most important aspect of these disciplines to Malta is their effect on planning. So spatial planning and infrastructure, and again, people got used to this concept very quickly. And then the more recent ones, engineering science, engineering design, environmental design, sorry, which is basically the performance, responding to today's requirements for better energy performance, better acoustical performance, and so on. It's more physics, if you like. And the more recent ones is the construction and property management, because, again, we try to look at, we have never really looked at the management of the construction industry properly, not of the construction process, but not even of things like estate management and post-construction. So that was set up to look at the construction process and the management of it. The 7th department is the visual arts. And the visual arts is the Belle Arti. Now, I have, my feelings, I mean, I'd like to see this remain there, because I thought of the link between art and architecture. But at the same time, I have to acknowledge that there are other movements outside our faculty. One of the wishes of the rectorate is that eventually this will form a school of the visual arts, just as the music, theater, and dance form the School of Performing Arts. So that is something which can happen in the future. But in the meantime, the Department of Visual Arts is doing very important work in the faculty to bridge the science and the art, because we've always have this dilemma: how much science ought you know, ought you have, and how much creativity, as if science doesn't have creativity. But of course, it's another debate if you want to have that. So we're now we have phased out the BEnA course, had the last graduates last year, except for two that are graduating this year, and we're now nearing the end of the first cycle of the new system, which involves a six-year program, starting with a diploma for in Design Foundation, which the Department of Visual Arts manages, then a three-year general degree, and then this opening of master's degrees in many disciplines. So as you said earlier, it reflects a bit what happened in the past, but we're doing it in the formal way. So if you're interested in engineering, you've got a master's program which is tailored for you. If you're interested in architecture, planning, environmental science, heritage, you know, the conservator architect.
Really looking, this rather overused word of holistic, but looking at architecture, built environment, really, in an holistic way, so that you can have people really covering every possible area.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really intrinsically in the world, it's not unique. What has happened is in the UK model that we took on board since the 19th century, it's not very common to find it. In the continental Europe, it is more common, much more common, to find this marriage. But curiously enough, in 1985, there was a Council of of Europe Ministers resolution that said that teaching of architecture, engineering, and planning and landscape should really have a degree of commonality. So we don't have landscape yet, that's one of my ambitions, but we're doing architecture, engineering, and planning. At least they stay together in the first four years, but then they also have links at the master's level. So I think looking at each discipline as part of a bigger discipline, I think is eventually, I hope, will lead to better results.
Well, that's fascinating, and I must say I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking to your lecturers over the last few programs. We've talked about anything from conservation to waste management to water management, seismic vulnerability, all sorts of things that one wouldn't immediately have associated with the Faculty of the Built Environment, but I can quite see now you've put it all in perspective, and thank you very much for doing that for us today, Professor Alex Tropiano.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.